Again, Dennis, I think great perspectives, and I really like some of the points you made, especially around the purpose of ERM to help organisations take the right risks and to help them achieve profitable returns. Sometimes we do tend to lose sight of that aim. And also your observations around how organisations understand failure and embed it in remediation into their processes in a meaningful way. And the last point around the importance of diversity, not only at the board level, but I think as ERM professionals, I think sometimes that is really overlooked. What we'd like to do now is just spend the next half an hour or so just going through some questions, and we'll just throw them over to the panel. We do have some questions, which is always a good sign. Please do continue to text them through. And I don't know if the number's not up there, so just in case you've forgotten it, 0417215300. I feel like I'm 125, there you go. A dyslexic chair, that's not what you need. Okay. So I think the first question which I'll throw over to the panel is around a comment that John made around the level of knowledge that the typical board would have, and their ability to truly understand risk management. And the question is there, are there similar capability gaps in risk management teams, and what are the opportunities for actuaries to address that knowledge gap? And I'll just throw that over to any of the panel members that have a view. Full of shaking of heads.
Yeah, well, I guess I have a view on most things, as people who know me would realise. John's both right and wrong. Yes, there's a significant knowledge gap on risk management per se. And that's because I think practitioners of risk management, like actuaries writing FCRs, actually really think it's so important that everyone should understand it. The real issue with risk management, in my mind, is having a board that's diverse enough that they can actually comprehend the outcomes of the risks the company wants to take. They don't have to know every fine detail. They have to ensure the business has the right leadership in place and has the right capacity to deal with issues, including positive and negative issues, rather than being practitioners in risk management. Are there roles for actuaries? I think there are roles for actuaries everywhere, but you have to be prepared to face the risk of being successful. And unfortunately, many actuaries don't want to face that risk. So they stay in staid and comfortable areas of practice that guarantee being relatively successful, but don't actually make the big enough difference to a business model that I think many people, I mean, actuaries are highly intelligent, articulate, have a deep understanding of profit drivers of an insurance business, and I can't believe they don't want to be in positions where they're utilising those profit drivers.
Okay, I guess I should pick it up. Looking at risk management teams, I think Joseph summed this up extremely well this morning in his opening address. What he said was, I think on a 10-year journey, we're about year two. I would have been a little more lenient than that and said year three or four. But what all it says is we've got a long way to go. I think the risk management teams, my experience with particularly in the banks, which tend to lead risk management, I think the insurers are coming up to speed very rapidly. Are we there? No, we're not. We've got a long way to go, as the sessions here today have shown up. There's a new way of thinking about risk because it's just not working for us in the business context. And that's going to be a big challenge. Is there room for an actuary? Yes. I think we missed the opportunity probably 10 years ago. We're now grappling with it. We are running really hard, but we need to run a bit harder. And I think there's great opportunities for actuaries.
Can I add? Yeah, I agree. I think there are great opportunities for actuaries. Actuaries that really spend time to work out how they're going to communicate the key issues, like I was saying earlier. I sort of reflect back. I mean, the organisation I've just come from has been through a lot of change. You can read all this in the newspaper. It's announced a £3 billion loss last year. I mean, massive dramas and all that sort of thing. And as a member of that board, I mean, it's a big organisation with lots of things going on around the world as well as in the UK. It's interesting now, just reflecting back, that what did I do when I got my board papers each month? And I knew a lot about what was going on in my part and the rest of the organisation, but not everything. The report I turned to first was the four-page risk report by the chief actuary. It's really interesting. I mean, it had none of the bullshit in it. It really went... It was a well-written report. It was... the chief risk officer there is a very good chief risk officer actuary. It cut through all the crap, and it really presented the issues, you know. And I know other board members from outside who weren't familiar with the organisation also went to that report first. So there's a great opportunity for us, I think, to cut through.
I have to say I agree with Trevor that there are opportunities for actuaries, and communication is so key. And I think actuaries are well positioned to communicate succinctly. You know, they do a lot of work around the analysis, and it's really important to communicate that well. But also to remember for, you know, the more difficult topics such as operational risk, that the whole conclusions are going to be supported by quantitative analysis and qualitative analysis, and not to forget the qualitative part, which is also important as some of the key points to make.
I think definitely a topic and something that we'll continue to discuss as time goes on. And the next question, I think, Elaine, you alluded to this in the in your comments and observations around the roles of boards and management potentially blurring.
Yeah, that is a very good point. I think it's not something that's just only happening recently. I think it's always been something that boards and management have been grappling with. I think with general insurers, it's particularly topical right now because of APRA's big emphasis on the new capital standards and ICAAP, and how the board have to take ownership of a document, because my sort of rule in my head was always directors direct and management managers. So taking ownership of a document sounds more like, it's definitely blurring the lines. So I think boards and management have to find their way through that statement by APRA and still have clear roles. And, you know, I think what APRA are really trying to say by boards taking ownership of the ICAAP statement is they need to understand it. They need to understand the implications of it before they approve it.
Any other comments on that?
Well, I think you see behaviour change depending on the circumstances. You know, that's what I've witnessed from time to time. When organisations get into trouble or strife, the boards tend to come down into the organisation in a big way. And again, there's a real opportunity for the risk function to, you know, present that information. And, you know, I've certainly been through experiences where that risk committee meeting was actually in many ways more important than the main board meeting, because that's where all the detail, you know, the people around the risk, the chairman of the risk committee's got a very important role. If he's got a good chief risk officer and supporting staff, I mean, they really can get through a lot of stuff there that you don't have the time at the main board, but it really gets into things in detail. So, yeah, I think it depends on the circumstances.
Yeah, there's no doubt that boards and management at various points of time appear to be blurred. But The board can't afford to step in the role of management. I mean, the fundamental thing that the board looks at is some really unusual things. So the board has direct personal liability for things like unpaid taxes and occupational health and safety and a few other things. I can assure you that's in many ways can be more important to some directors than the risk appetite statement, because that's a very personal risk appetite statement. But the point about it, that is, at any point of change, when either APRA or any regulator is starting to give more and more direction about what they want and how they want it done, there's no doubt that boards and management are very close during those periods. And as a director, one of the things we have to be really careful of, we don't step into the role of management. And I think that's the hardest thing when you become a director and you've been an executive, is that you tend to want to make sure that they do it the way you did it. The way I always did it was wrong anyway, so that was an easy one for me to step back from. But it's very easy to get too involved. And I think all new directors certainly need help from somebody else to try and get them to step back a little bit, give management the space to manage, and directors the capacity to think through the issues that are presented to them.
I think, again, some interesting observations there, especially around the fiduciary duties of directors and their personal liability. But then the next question, I think, leads on from that nicely, which is always a good thing. Is ERM too difficult for boards to own, and is ownership, in the true sense of the word, too much to expect from board members?
Yeah, I'll have a go at that one. The answer is yes. I actually don't like the blurring between the directors and management that's going on. I think it's wrong. I think you'll end up in trouble. And the reason is that unless you're going to have directors there almost as semi-executives, because they just can't put the time in. There's a difference between ownership and understanding. And I think you can the directors clearly have to understand, but they don't. They can't own.
Why can't they own?
They just don't have the time to actually take full responsibility for. Ownership means I have developed it, I have thought it through, and I understand all the consequences. As a director, that's an impossible position to be in.
Another point that's related to this is APRA take very seriously independent directors, particularly in insurance companies. There have to be a certain proportion of independent directors that are unrelated to the company. And as soon as you start to bring in impositions such as owning documents, then you're starting to imply that the independence is no longer there. So that's also an important line to not cross over, I think.
I think a great point there, Elaine. Following on again, this is... couldn't have been scripted better. Employee representations at board levels. How do you ensure that people have access to the board to express their view? And this may touch on some of the topics that we talked about in some of the earlier sessions today around corporate culture, etc.
Well,
here we go.
Yeah, okay. Sorry, I'm filling the silence. I mean, I think it's difficult to have employee representation at board level. I think that there's no difficulty at all in having employees come before the board and express their concerns or make their comments. But to have a situation where you impose or you insist that you have an employee representative, I think it's quite difficult. If you think about that employee, what is he or she going to do when things get tough? He or she's probably only got one chance to call management and say he or she violently disagrees with the chief executive or whatever, because whatever you say, you've only got that card, I think, to play once. So I don't think it works. I think what you've got to do is you've got to try and encourage the culture we heard about earlier, the culture for the bad news to get up through to the top of the organisation. And I like that slide we saw earlier about the AMP putting that in the values to how many breaches are self-notified. I mean, I think that's a very, very powerful idea. I've always said to people working for me, look, you've got to get me the bad news fast. If you can get the bad news to me just before the regulator or the chairman or the press, I can use that time to our advantage, right? Understand? Right. Okay, and we sort of talked about that from time to time. And I got to a situation in Scotland where we had quite a bit of bad news. An organisation was forced to demutualise and all that sort of thing. And these fellas and girls used to come to the office door and say, hey, boss, got some more bad news. Taking me a bit too literally. But you do need to try and encourage the transmission upwards. There's all the natural barriers to stop that, and you've got to try and reinforce that idea.
I think employee representation doesn't work. If you really want to see it really well in practice, go to Germany. The boards there have union and employee representation on them, and community representation, very little shareholder representation, and the board makes no decisions. All the decisions are made by the executive board. And the executive board often has an independent chairman and a few independent non-executives on it that are elected, that are shareholder representatives. So I'm not sure you can ever say that it doesn't work, but it's really hard to see it working. In a large organisation, as Trevor said, the most important thing is create a culture where bad news and good news filters to the top. Mm. If you don't create the culture, you will suffer the problem. Okay. And that's all those examples are where the culture was wrong, because people didn't actually believe it mattered. Okay. And if the chief executive and the board doesn't want to enforce the culture, then it won't happen.
John, Elaine, any observations? Okay, great. Next question, building on culture and the importance of diversity. How can an appropriate level of diversity be achieved in boards with a requirement for directors to deeply understand and own highly technical documents such as ICAP?
I think boards should still achieve an appropriate level of diversity. Definitely on boards, when you do have diverse boards, there are particular expertises that the different directors have, And even though all directors are equally responsible, certainly they do look to directors with particular expertises to give a little bit more colour to particular documents. So I think that I still think a diverse board is the most important, and highly technical documents need to be in a great layout, as Trevor mentioned, 4 pages with the key points explained, so that directors without that deep technical expertise in that area can still follow the key findings and the implications for the business that those documents are trying to communicate.
Right, okay.
Can I just add something on that? For those of you who have never done the Institute of Company Directors Director course, and my apologies to the accountant that actually ran the session, because I can't remember his bloody name. But he ran a session on understanding a set of company accounts. The most important thing, we had the set of company accounts in front of us, and there was a name on the label, I won't say the name, and he said, let's understand the company accounts and how do you do that? Well, the first thing you should do is you don't open them and you don't read them. The first thing you do is we'll discuss what we know about the company. What do we think happened in the last 12 months in that period with that business? So actually have an informed discussion from people who know nothing about this company other than its customers. And it was amazing the insights you got. By the time you went to the accounts, you knew what you really wanted to look for. So technical knowledge is not a prerequisite to understanding an ICAAP statement. Mm-hmm. The prerequisite is a challenging mind that actually listens to other people and as a community of interest can actually develop an understanding of what they expected to come from it. Mm-hmm. That was a really powerful session for me.
Mm. I think the importance of the context is sometimes overseen by people, and that leads on again to the next question around do we need a mandate that boards have a director who is qualified in risk management? And then the line, you know, we have enough actuaries in the world and not enough risk professionals. I think the question is actually in the first part of that comment.
Well, if you're listed on the ASX, you're required to go through a process that identifies the skills necessary. I presume other listed exchanges have similar sorts of rules. That would show that one up very quickly.
Okay. Next question, slightly changing direction. Question to the panel. Are you supportive of APRA's proposal to require chief risk officers and its separation from appointed actuaries and CFO roles? Second part of the question may lean to unconscious bias. Do you think it will improve risk culture or make it more of a compliance mentality?
I think APRA's proposal to have a separate person for chief risk officer. There's two things here. One is to make sure companies are paying enough attention to the risks to which they're exposed, and I think that's important and a good thing to do. To make them pay attention by having a separate person in the CRO role. I don't know if that's necessarily the right thing to enforce. I think it does depend on the person's expertise. Those sorts of proposals, I think, are only necessary when you really absolutely have to have independence between those two roles. So if APRA has reasons why the CRO role has to be independent from the appointed actuary role, then I think it's the right thing to do. But I haven't seen anything that has convinced me that those two roles absolutely have to be separate people. So even though I am supportive of the fact that companies must pay attention to this, I'm not sure that this is the right way to go about it.
Isn't it, Elaine, it's a function of the size of the company as well?
It would be to some extent, yeah.
Okay. Three lines of defence, a much maligned expression. Do you see a blurring of the three lines of defence in business, and how do you highlight the distinction in the boardroom?
Yeah, I don't see, in the experiences I've had, I don't see a blurring. I think that the three lines of defence is a useful device to explain what we're trying to do. My experience is that it's taken a while to get that three line of defence idea understood at all the various levels of a complex organisation. But once you do, the organisation can understand things better. So I think it works quite well.
I think it probably comes out in a negative sense, Peter. Mm-hmm. It's when something's gone wrong, then the board will look at which one of these lines of defence failed.
Yes.
I think that it comes more negative than positive.
That's a good point.
Well, I think the three lines are absolutely critical, and I can't say how you can blur them. you know, if they're embedded properly, it's impossible to blur them because the board has a clear charter that the first line is part of the customer-facing unit that's going to actually deal with the problem on the face-to-face. The second line is going to support that and monitor how they do that, and the third line is going to review and monitor the entire organisation. It's just, I can't even comprehend how people could actually think they're blurred. If they're blurred, then there's something wrong with that business.
I think the key part of the expression you just used was the first line actually dealing with the risks.
Yeah.
I think that is quite a challenge in some organisations. Moving on. Where are we? Okay, APRA mentioned that APRA will reply on board assessment of risk culture. What are your views on how risk culture can be assessed through the board or via the board?
I think it's very difficult. I mean, it's worth having a go at, but it's a very... We heard from the previous session that, there are some interesting techniques, but it's not a simple task.
Has anyone seen effective or tips and techniques that we could potentially think about as professionals around presenting risk culture to some of the organisations that you represent at board level?
I think it's incredibly difficult to just measure risk culture. You actually attempt to measure the culture of the organisation and its engagement and the quality of its leadership. So there's not going to be one sort of all-embracing measure. There are, you know, pretty sound tools to measure the quality of leadership. They're probably more developed than they've been around now for perhaps 15 or 20 years or even longer. To measure employee engagement is also a tool that's been around for a really long time. Culture is something I think in many ways directors see, and I think, but you get the response from those. APRA does rely on the board to assess the culture of the organisation. I hate the word risk culture. Every time someone has some specialty, they want to put the bloody word in front of every other word that's important. The important word is culture, and the other important word is profit, and a few other words like that.
What was that word?
Profit. You know that unusual word? It's putting risk in front of it. I don't know. People must think it's something special. It's not.
I actually have a problem with the concept because, again, it comes back to this management and board responsibilities. It isn't the responsibility, in my view, for the board to assess the risk culture. It's the responsibility of the board to make sure it's being done and that they are seeing the results of it. That's it.
Good point. Okay, last question's a relatively easy one for such an esteemed panel. What do you think would be the reasons for the next financial institution failure in Australia?
No idea.
No, I know.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah,
perfect.
No.
On a no-names basis, yeah, obviously.
No, I think it'll be the... we've had the advantage of having this on the screen for a few minutes, so I thought about it. I think it'll be the same reason that's been the cause for most of the failures in the last 100 years. And I think it will be it'll be management running away and not being controlled, supervised, kept in check by their boards. I think if you look at a lot of the financial failures in our industry and in other industries, rapid growth and management's out of control, believing their own press, if you like, and lack of challenge at the board is what's brought a lot of organisations undone and will probably, I'm afraid, happen again.
And what's really fascinating about failure is you've struggled to find on the liability side of the balance sheet. If you actually look at all the entities that have failed, it's always been on the asset side. Every time there's a major failure, someone has the assets, they've traded in derivatives and attempt to hide it, they've invested in something that was a stupid investment. Mm-hmm. The most common one is they've bought something and paid too much for it.
Hear, 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 hear.
Okay. I think never a truer word spoken. I think the Walker Review about the difference between what's actually going on in the business, what the board and executive management thought was happening, was cited there as one of the main reasons of the GFC. We have another question. If not the board, who or which parties do you think should take ownership of the RAS?
Well, I think management should take ownership of the RAS in the usual way, and the board will review it and give feedback and give colour, but I think management has to take ownership of the RAS. So clearly it's really important, so the CEO would take ownership, but I would have thought ably assisted by the CRO.
Agreed.
Agreed.
Spot on.
There you go. Sort of last call for questions. I know we're the only thing standing between you and the drink session, but does anyone else have any other questions? Right. I think the next thing I'm asked to do here is to thank the speakers and present the gifts, which I haven't received. So I think someone else will be presenting those to you later on. Do have to remind the participants to fill in your feedback summary survey. And also what I'd like to do now is to... Oops, there you go. Wonderful. There you go. Is to...
I knew we should look behind the chair.
That's the other trick a director needs to be aware of. Is to really just introduce John Newman, the Institute's president, to conclude today's session.